very ironic that you had an American Samoan roommate while Lance was actually an American Samoa. That's got to be the great irony there.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I have to say that we are moving close to the end of the show. It's we have a few minutes left that I'll need to do some wrap up and closing down. And Lance, thank you so much for calling. We appreciate your call.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, and I just want to say good luck to Justin and all he's doing.
I completely agree, and thank you, Lance. And that was Lance, the co-writer with Justin. In a lot of these venues, Justin, I want to say to you, what a remarkable guest you have been. I have thoroughly enjoyed myself and even forgotten about my scratchy throat. You're a very entertaining and engaging guest.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on. I was very much looking forward to this. This is very, very cool.
Well, I'm so glad you're able to join us, and we would love to have you on again. We didn't get to all of your tracks, but eventually we will use them as a track of the night, and you'll be credited for them as we use them. And we would certainly like to follow your career and hear back from you at some time in the future. Maybe we can do this again.
Sure, yeah, that'd be awesome.
Wonderful. Well, Lance, I'm so sorry. Justin, my very, very best to you, and thank you so much for being on the show.
Hey, thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it, and have a wonderful evening.
Thank you, sir, and good night to you. And my friends, that is Justin Utley, one of the more amazing music interviews we've had. What an interesting story he tells us about being a missionary and about growing up in the in Salt Lake City, and about Abercrombie, and about the music and his life and leaving the church. My God, the man talked about everything you can imagine. I was so glad to have Justin Utley on the show this evening, and his archive will be posted tomorrow. So I need to tell you that there will not be a horn section this evening. My voice is weird, and John is down tonight. So Bob is going to be replaying the Guy James segment from earlier today. And for those of you who missed the Guy James show, it was a great show from this afternoon. And so in closing, here's Cynthia Manley reminding you to...
my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show. The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Good afternoon, everybody. The Guy James Show coming to you live from the Omni Shoreham Hotel at the annual Take Back America Conference. And what a lively conference it is. So glad to be with you this afternoon. Hope we don't have any audio problems going on right now. It's hard to tell in this chaotic situation as we described it to you yesterday. A lot going on in here. And so if we have a little glitch here and there, you'll forgive us because it is, well, as radio roads go, this one is controlled chaos, as I guess be the best thing for it. Absolutely controlled chaos. All right. We're trying to get things just perfect here. Hope that's okay now. Anyway, here we are. We've got some good guests scheduled today. Robert Borisage, the head of the whole conference, is supposed to be over here in just a couple of minutes. We have an odd group of people here, in a way. Everybody knows how the left is. We are a conglomeration, a little bit of everything. They're all here from the far, 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 far left to the middle of the road. So they're all here, everybody promoting their cause. And as you well know, on the left, there are hundreds of causes to be had. One of the seminars must have just let out because all of a sudden we've got a zillion people walking through the hall again. I see Norman Lear standing right beside me now wearing his signature little hat. We're going to try and have him on a little earlier, but I guess he's all booked up. We shall see. But yeah, Norman Lear's the guest of honor tonight for the Lifetime Achievement Award. And yes, he does actually wear that little hat everywhere. That's not a hat I have in my wardrobe. I don't think it's a hat anybody has in their wardrobe. Anyway, Norman's sitting over there. I think he's sitting over there with Mark Levine right now. I think Mark is taping a segment with Norman Lear. Mark and I are at the same table here today. He was taping some interviews just a little bit earlier. And he... and actually got lots of good interviews taped. And we have with us now, I think we're ready to start, probably one of the busiest, if not the busiest guy at the whole thing. In fact, has been busy for a long time setting this up. One of the co-founders of this great organization and this conference every year, we have Robert Borisage. Bob, welcome to the program.
How are you?
We've been with you every year at the... conference so far, and I must say I spoke with you last evening and you mentioned that you might be a little bit surprised because we don't have presidential candidates this year at the turnout.
Yeah, no, I expected the turnout would fall because we didn't, you know, last year we had every presidential candidate going into the primary season, so you knew people were going to come out to see them. But this year Congress is out of session, and so the Congress people are out of town and the presidential candidates aren't here. But you know, this is a progressive movement that clearly has increased energy and an increased sense of its own self-confidence and capacity, so they came to see each other.
to see each other, and it's more about us this year, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, absolutely.
That's kind of the theme of the whole thing. As we often talk about, the liberals are like trying to herd a bunch of ducks or whatever. We're flying off in all different directions. And we've seen plenty of the candidates anyway lately.
Right.
It's not like they need a bunch of publicity right now. So it is about us, and it is about progressive ideas. The turnout, as opposed to past years,
it's as big as it's ever been.
Wow! And this is a fabulous facility here.
Yeah,
I got to tell you, I've never been here at the Omni before as a guest or at a Radio Row, and I'm very impressed.
How far, Union Hotel.
Are you like the Rose Bowl? Do you start planning next year's event tomorrow?
No, not really. Part of it is we try to make these the themes somewhat topical, so we have to get a sense of the political frame before we really buckle down. But it starts months ahead of time.
And topical this year?
Well, this year we really wanted to talk through as a progressive movement what it meant to both drive the ideas into the debate, into the political debate, to mobilize the largest turnout of vote we could this fall to take the country back, but then to sustain the activity to keep these politicians accountable once we elected them. And so, because we had the experience of 06 where we had Democratic majorities in both the House and the Senate and expected the war to end and it didn't, we wanted people not to give up on politics, but to redouble their efforts on politics, but to also be clear about an independent movement that holds politicians accountable.
You know, it seems like an awesome job to get some of these people elected, but the sustaining what the electorate sends them there for seems to be even more difficult, and we certainly have had some problems with that this past year.
Yeah, no question. You know, you're a senator, you've got to raise, the way we do elections, you've got to raise a ton of money, right? So you start electing a Democratic majority, then all of a sudden Big Pharma starts giving its contributions to Democratic senators and the health insurance industry and big oil. And, you know, the Senate Finance Committee, controlled by Democrats, couldn't get themselves to move a bill to get hedge fund operators, billionaire hedge fund operators, to pay the same rate as their receptionists. Well, tax rate, that's unacceptable. And so we kicked off the conference with Donna Edwards, who, you know, she took on an 8-term Democratic incumbent who had voted for the war and with his contributors and not his constituents, and she took him out, and we wanted that people to get that message.
Spoke to Donna just a little while ago, and she should serve as a warning to a lot of people, I think.
Exactly.
A remarkable job she did getting in, and there are several other Democrats around the country that could befall the same situation.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of Democrats that lost touch with the working people, the majority of their constituents, and they thought they could deal with them by either being liberal on social issues or being conservative on social issues, and they could do their economics with the corporations and the wealthy people that could fund their campaigns. And this country's changing, and the progressive movement's changing, and we're going to demand a lot more from people now.
Well, demand is the word. We've become a lot less tolerant. I've noticed this past year a lot less tolerant. I spoke to John Conyers a little while ago, and as you well know, he's I don't know if he feels he's suffering over the lack of the impeachment and all that, but he certainly has got some extra gray hair on account of it, because people are really working on him, holding him accountable this year.
Well, and you know, the fact is that whether you got to impeachment, this Congress should have started a series of investigations. Henry Waxman's done it on a range of areas, but we needed a series of investigations on these presidential assertions of really extraordinary prerogatives, of imperial license, if you will. And we should have had investigations on the secrecy, on the wiretapping, on the war-making assertions, on the signing statement assertions, and laid it out. And then, collectively, that could have been the bill of particulars for an impeachment. But whether you got to the impeachment or not, because he's going to go out of office in another 6 months, you had to do the bill of particulars to call it back into, you know, to rein it back in. And I think it's unfortunate it hasn't happened.
Yeah, the opposition's gotten off the hook too many times this year, not been held accountable. Oh, we have this civil suit right now on the all of a sudden the words escape me, from Harriet, about Harriet Myers and not appearing
in
court,
refusing to appear, right?
Yeah, pretty much
provide the information on the firing of the attorneys general.
Yeah, it was a poke in the eye to the Congress, and literally don't know what's going to end up being done about it. Practically nothing.
Right. At least they pursued the suit. You know, I'd rather they did that than nothing. I think we've rolled over too much and not confronted enough. But I do think that this energy that you see unleashed in the primaries, with increased participation, increased excitement, young people coming in large numbers, combined with the conditions of the country where you've got the war going on and the economy going into the pits, people are going to demand and expect a lot more from their legislators.
Noticed a lot of young people here this year.
Pretty good, huh?
I'm excited about it. A lot of the young organizations are here in the exposition hall part of it. Lots of young people, and perhaps that's why this great turnout is happening this year. Some of the demographics I've seen is that we're getting a good turnout in the primaries.
Yeah, well, the primaries have broken every record ever since, you know, the largest one previously was in '88 when Jackson ran in the primaries, and this has broken those records. And young people doubled their vote as a percentage of an increased vote. Latinos doubled their vote. Women, single women, are up as a percentage of the vote. It's exciting.
And a lot of that's because of people that go home from conferences like this and get to work. And you've got all the different seminars and so forth that take place here. People learn, and they go back to their communities, and they redouble their efforts, and they learn things about campaigning and getting out the vote and so forth. That's why something like this, it just magnifies exponentially as people leave here.
Yeah, it is truly exciting. You know, Bill Foster, the guy who beat the Republican in Dennis Hastert, former House Speaker Dennis Hastert's Republican district in Illinois, he came here last year and spoke on our inequality panel. And spoke as a businessman about why we had to have a more progressive tax system. So, and he had never even thought about running for Congress.
And historically, what was it, a week ago last Monday, the guy raised his hand, took his oath of office, and his vote that day
on the ethics
made
bill.
The difference.
Yep.
And because
quite
he was here at this conference, it is. It's a wonderful story. I don't know of another case on the very day the guy took the oath of office, his vote was the deal maker. He has to be very proud. I didn't know that he came here and spoke last. There's so many speakers here.
Yeah.
I see Norman Lear is here. He's the guest of honor tonight for his lifetime achievement.
Right.
Who else have you had the dignitaries so far? It's
well, at the conference, tonight we're honoring Van Jones and Majora Carter for their work on green-collar jobs and the potential that, you know, building a new energy economy has for creating jobs in our urban areas as well as the new manufacturing sector. And it's really exciting work. And we're honoring Jan Schakowsky, who's the congresswoman who's a great pit bull fighter and has been really pursuing the outsourcing of war in Iraq to Blackstone and the other places, Blackwater and the other places. So that's tonight. The this morning we kicked off the conference with a panel that I really liked on the tension between King leading an independent justice movement and President Johnson, a liberal Democrat, and Kennedy, but wanting not to do as much as King wanted done, and the tensions between the independent movement and the liberal in the White House. And we had Reverend Jackson, who was at King's side, Jesse Jackson. We had Roger Wilkins, who was an assistant attorney general at Johnson's side, and then Taylor Branch, who was the historian of the era and had you know, is really quite passionate about it. It was an amazing panel. I mean, really
we lost somebody to a couple of years ago, an old friend of mine that would have been a good panelist for that. Perhaps you knew him, Leonard Marks. Leonard was Lyndon Johnson's lawyer way back when, and Lyndon could tell a lot of stories about the tension between Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson and so forth. In fact, Leonard lived right here in this very complex at the end where they have some of the apartments. Also this year we've had the Maria Levy Award.
Right, and that's going to, I'm blacking his name, but a wonderful man who helped build Brave New Films, the Robert Greenwald film operation, and really linked it up with the web in the most creative marketing and distribution system that's been developed, and did it in exactly the Maria Levy way, behind the scenes, without taking much credit, and it's going to be a real pleasure to give him an honor.
The Maria Levy way. As I look over through Radio Row, and we miss Maria, it seems like we ought to see her over there. She did work.
She's the one who invented this idea.
Yeah.
She came to us and said, you ought to do this. And then we said, well, I don't know. And so then she raised the money to do it the first time.
Well, you couldn't say no to right. Maria once right. once she got started on you. You just couldn't say no. Bob, I want to thank you so much for being on the program. I want to thank you for all you do with putting this conference together. It's a huge undertaking, and it does my heart good to look around and see all these notables here. Anybody who is anybody on the left is here, and maybe even some middle of the road folks as well. Thanks very much.
Good to see you. Thank you.
Robert Borisodge, the executive director and one of the founders of the Take Back America Conference. A lively conference it is. We've got, once again, I know you hear some of the background noise going on, but it's just conversations going on everywhere. Looks like the floor of the House of the Representatives or the Senate sometimes, but little individual conversations going on all over the place. But we've got quite a crowd in here today. I don't know how many broadcasters we've got going on at the moment, probably, maybe eight or so. And as we mentioned yesterday, a lot of our broadcast friends that we see at all these Peter B. Collins and John Elliott and all the ones that you're all aware of. Mark Levine right is here right now. We've got an interesting guest coming up here in just a moment. A guy that everybody would love to meet, Anton Gunn, is going to be with us. And Anton is a real activist. Anton is someone who's going to speak on behalf of. Somebody said to me yesterday, you had several people speak on behalf of Hillary Clinton. Where is your interview for Barack Obama? Well, it just so happens that's the way they scheduled everything. So Anton is running for the House of Representatives in South Carolina himself, but he's also a very good spokesman for Barack Obama, and we're going to have him here just for a moment or so. I see Anton standing over there right now, so we'll get him hooked up here in just a moment or two. Again, we're coming to you live from the beautiful Omni Shoreham Hotel Complex. For those of you looking on the map, it's at the corner of Calvert and Connecticut, one of the most scenic spots in Washington, D.C. Looking at the news today, I am somewhat surprised, as I know are many of you, maybe not surprised, but here we are again. The stock market going way up. And why is the stock market going way up? Because interest rates have been cut for the fat cat Wall Street people, the bailout of the Bear Stearns bailout. Tell me, when you're losing your home, you're losing your car, you're losing your job, losing everything you have, anybody from the federal government call you up and say, hey, we'll bail you out? And that's pretty much what's happened here. They gave a gift to Morgan Stanley to be able to buy Bear Stearns. They pumped, $250 billion or so into Wall Street. I'm beginning to sense, and there's a lot of talk here at this conference, about the government doing everything and anything necessary to bail out the big Wall Street firms, and doing literally nothing to bail out the average American. And once again, here we are in that position. Everything for the big corporations, nothing for the working man. And it's causing many, many hard feelings from many people I've talked to. It's been a big, big topic of conversation here at this conference this week. And last night I had a long, long discussion about that with some folks. It's really fascinating that the market, the last I saw, was up at least 150 points today. I don't know how what it is just at the moment. I'm not technically capable of taking a look at it right at the moment. But, you know, all is well on the market, and the average American is suffering, and it's simply because they've taken our money, folks, our money, and pumped it in to Wall Street. It's not right. It's never right to do that. I'll warn Bob here right now. We're going to take a little break anytime he's ready. The Bear Stearns folks, they took the profits when they were available. They distributed them to their shareholders. And now, well, when trouble comes along, we pay the freight. Isn't that the way it is? We're going to pause for a little break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Don't go away.
is the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
Tune in to Foxed Up this Thursday, midnight Eastern, for part two of Lenin on Lenin, Blame It on Bermuda, where we'll examine the creative process and how the ideas for Double Fantasy happened.
When we'd made a tentative decision to make a record, I didn't have any material, then suddenly it all came to me. All the songs that are on Double Fantasy all came within a period of 3 weeks. In Bermuda, after 5 years of nothing.
So be there this Thursday, midnight Eastern, on Foxed Up. Right here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
I just have to let it go.
This is Billy Shears, and hey, thanks for lending an ear.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. The dreadful landmark is upon us. Bush's Iraq War, now 5 years old. And the costs of this war have been astronomical, no matter what calculator you use. On the most important human side, the results have been hideous. We've lost 4,000 soldiers and 30,000 more have been wounded, many of them grievously. Iraqi civilians have suffered enormously, with hundreds of thousands killed and millions turned into refugees. Then there's the financial cost. We're wasting $3 billion a week on this fiasco. And when all is said and done, we'll have spent upwards of $2 trillion, enough to pay for universal health care for every American for 12 years. And the kicker is, the war hasn't made us any safer. It's made us more imperiled. Serving as a recruiting call for Al-Qaeda and a training ground using live ammunition and live targets, our soldiers. Enough already. This is a disaster times five. We cannot allow it to reach a sixth. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
All right, we are back at the Take Back America Conference, coming to you live from the Omni Shoreham Hotel, and it's my great pleasure right now to let you know about a gentleman that some of you may know about, some of you may not. He's a guy that I knew about before this conference. He's a guy I knew about outside of politics, actually. He doesn't think I keep track of, maybe he doesn't think I keep track of things this long ago, but I've got Anton Gunn with me, and Anton, before this conference, was well known to me as a football player. And, of course, he was a football player at the University of South Carolina, and you all know how I feel about my beloved Ohio State Buckeyes. And you all also know that the University of South Carolina, twice in bowl games that I attended, by the way, well, they edged out the Buckeyes just a little bit. They beat them just, well, maybe more than a little bit. The first time was close, the second time, but I had to sit and take this from him earlier yesterday. We talked about it. But, Anton, welcome to the program.
I'm glad to be here. And just to clarify, we whipped Ohio State very soundly both times.
Well, whip is a harsh word.
Very harsh.
It's a word the Buckeyes aren't used to hearing
right.
Very much.
Well, you guys came back pretty good in the second game.
Yeah.
You threw like three touchdowns in the fourth quarter to make it close.
Yeah, you were just making it easy on us, right? It was, well, nice of you.
Yeah, it was good. It was a good game. Good time.
You played one of those games.
I did. I played in neither one of those games I played. I played in the Carquest Bowl. There were a few years before that, but I was down there for both games. A lot of friends, a lot of support down there, so I went down to visit.
Yeah, there was a few Gamecocks.
Just one or two.
A couple, anyway.
Times.
We could, Anton and I could sit and talk college football all day long. I love college football, and obviously he does as well.
Very much.
Very much. But we're here today to talk about something else. Anton is an interesting guy. Number one of the things I want to talk about right off for his benefit right now, you're running for office.
I am, very much so.
What got you to do that? Well, first of all, tell everybody where you're running.
Well, I'm running for the South Carolina House of Representatives. That's the state legislature in South Carolina, a House district in the northeast part of Columbia, northeast part of Richland County, House District 79. You can learn more about me at www.electantongun.com. And I my long and short story is that I've been a community organizer and an activist in the state for many, many years, and I got, you know, tired of watching divisive politics not address the real issues that matter to the voters in the state, that matter to the people in the state. So I decided to challenge a 12-year incumbent Republican in a majority Republican district that had voted Republican for basically the last, you know, 15 to 16 years. And everybody told me I was crazy. And but one thing I do know is I know people, and I know community organizing, and I know how to work hard and really find out what's important to people. So at the end of the day, I lost by 298 votes in 2006 to this 12-year incumbent Republican. And out of 14,000 voters, actually, I lost by 298, less than 2%, 1.9% to be exact of the vote is what I lost by. And I did good, but I decided that wasn't enough, so I'm coming back around again in 2008, and the incumbent has decided to retire, so he's not going to seek re-election. So it's an open seat, but the Republican Party have recruited a strong candidate, a well-funded candidate, by the way. So I have to challenge her for this seat, and I'm going to work very hard to get it.
Well, we've got a different climate this time around, though, don't we?
Yes, very much so. It's a season of change, and change is good. And I think people are more aware of the political process now, which does nothing but help new candidates, young candidates, people in communities. It's an incredible opportunity we have to begin to make change and elect new leadership. Leadership that's forward-thinking, that identifies with the future and it can work for the future and really represents a multitude of various constituencies. And I think that's what's happening with me, and that's what's happening with a lot of people.
That's the northeast side of
Columbia.
Of Columbia.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Northeast Richland County. Part of it is in Kershaw County, which is a smaller county outside of Columbia near Camden, South Carolina.
Okay, the west side of Columbia is a place where they got that great hot dog shop
over there. Yeah, they got hot dogs everywhere.
Well, they got that great hot dog shop over in the west side. I pulled in there one time, told them I drove all the way from Florida just to get a hot dog.
That's great.
They bought that story.
And you got good barbecue all over the state as well, too. So if you want some real barbecue, you need to come to South Carolina.
Well, they got that yellow barbecue in Kentucky.
Well, they got,
Maurice's.
No, I don't want any Maurice's barbecue.
No, me either. I walked in there one time and said, we got yellow barbecue. I said, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's right.
Didn't know there was such a thing.
You got vinegar-based and ketchup-based and mustard-based barbecue, so we got all kinds, and depending on which part of the state you're from, you might, those are fighting words if you say yellow-based barbecue or mustard-based barbecue. So I'm a vinegar guy myself, so let me just keep it there.
Yeah. I'm fond of telling somebody I was at a country crossroad one time outside of Columbia, and there was four signs. And each one of them, four different directions pointing to barbecue joints.
That's right. That's what matters in South Carolina is barbecue. Good barbecue and good sweet tea.
Matters to me. Yeah, you're not a native of South Carolina.
I'm not.
And so you have probably, as a lot of athletes have, you know, a lot of people talk about athletes, you know, they go to football and they go play football and blah, blah, blah. You've taken your notoriety from that and used it for something really positive.
Yeah, I grew up in Virginia. I'm originally from Virginia Beach, Virginia, is where I graduated from high school. And came to South Carolina to play football and fell in love with the state, the wonderful people there, the quality of life and open space. And I got involved in the community. I mean, I started in college as a kind of a volunteer for different service projects. But after school was over with, I wanted to stay committed to community work and use my celebrity to read to kids at elementary school and work on other kind of community projects and kind of built a new community of people, a new family of people that weren't my biological family but nonetheless supported me like I was one of their own. And that's one of the things I can say about South Carolina is that once you get there and get a part of the community, it's a place that you don't ever really want to leave.
Well, that's my favorite part. I know South Carolina well, and that whole area, Spartanburg, Columbia, Anderson,
yep,
all through there. I love that area right in
there. That's good stuff.
And Columbia as well. I like South Carolina. Well, we could give geography the high country and the low country and all that,
yep,
but good food. Yeah, there's a restaurant in Columbia called Lizard's Thicket.
Yes, I'll be there tomorrow morning at 7:30.
Will you?
Yes, I will.
I love that place.
Lizard's Thicket is the best meat and three there is going. And,
I have a hard time remembering that name. I've spent a lot of time in Columbia.
Yeah.
Watching their football, though.
If you want to watch real football, you got to come to Columbia.
Yeah, you've never been to Columbus and seen it.
I don't want to go to Columbus.
105,000 people. I got to tell everybody, Anton could have been a Buckeye.
I could have been.
Could have been.
Could have been.
Probably made the right decision. I don't know.
I think I did.
You are listed, and it's something I didn't know until an hour or so ago, that you're one of the top political commentators in the hip-hop generation.
Yes.
How did you get involved in the hip-hop community?
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, hip-hop is how I got political in the very first place. I was blessed to grow up in a time when the music wasn't, a bunch of noise and foolishness like a lot of people hear on radio today. It was really positive message for young people about how to take care of yourself, how to live your life, and responsibility, and that you needed to educate yourself. And that's what stuck in my gut when I was, breakdancing in the early 1980s, that, I needed to arm myself with education and arm myself with
a mind. You were a breakdancer.
Yeah, I was. That's when I was a little bit smaller than I am now.
Okay.
But I spent a lot of time with the music, and the music is a cultural identity, and it's about a new way of doing things, a way of taking leadership roles. There's a lot of people. When you see youth activism, to me, that's hip-hop activism. When you see 18 to 30-year-olds getting involved in politics, getting involved in business, a different way than previous generations have ever got involved, to me, that's hip-hop. That's the whole essence of creating your own space. And generations have called it different things over and over again, but for Generation X, Generation Y, millennials, whatever you want to call them, to me, that's all the hip-hop generation. And what I try to do is give voice to young people about their role in society, that why it matters for you to be involved, why it matters for you to participate, why it matters for you to own a business, why it matters for you to contribute something that is greater than you, and to leave a legacy for other people behind. And that's one of the things that the music has done for me, that the artists that are never on the radio now, but they were on the radio 25 years ago, they've left a legacy of people like me and many of my friends who continue to stay involved in the community, that do lots of community things, that that work hard to make America and the world a better place. To me, that's hip-hop. And I think that's what it's all about, and that's what more people should be about.
Yeah, whatever vehicle it takes. And
that's right.
And if that's getting the youth involved, because as you know, in past, well, it's getting better. It's getting
right.
better every election. We're
yep.
getting a greater participation of people that are realizing your message and that it's important to get off their cans and get out and do something
right.
about it instead of sit home and gripe about it.
Right. And some of that is really the way I talk about it is that, young people never really participated before because they really didn't see a lot of candidates that they could identify with or that understood what it's like to have to come out of undergraduate school with $90,000 student loan debt or, the fact that you get a job and doesn't really pay a great wage so you can't pay your student loans and then it doesn't provide good health care. So now that candidates are speaking to those issues and sharing those experiences and coming from a cultural and generational context that they clearly understand, people want to vote for candidates that are like them. And I think that's why you see young people getting involved in voting, and that's why you see young people like me running for office, because there's a new energy and a new movement and excitement, and the way to capitalize on that is to be a part of the process. And so as a candidate, I'm a part of that process, and I'm giving young people an example of somebody that they can vote for that believes in what they believe in, understand the issues that they're going through, but at the same time is connected to the larger world community. And that's what you have.
And that segues into something I wanted to talk to you about. You are supporting a candidate
yes,
for the presidency.
I am.
And you have actively worked in his campaign.
I sure have.
Tell me why.
That candidate, of course, is Barack Obama. And I literally got involved in his campaign because it goes back to when I was running for the legislature in 2006. I was trying to bring a message of unity, of hope, and why we needed to move forward. But I definitely couldn't clearly articulate it the way Barack has articulated. And I knew that if we had someone that can set an example of why it's important to be involved, that it can inspire people to participate, then it was my job to do whatever I could do to make sure that this was an example that everybody in the world could see. And so Barack Obama is that example. I believe in his integrity, his authenticity, his, you know, no spinning it, you know, always telling the truth and being honest with people about how he thinks about stuff. And knowing that sometimes, you know, you think about stuff in different ways, that you don't always have the right answer or don't have any answer whatsoever, because we have a lot of complex problems in America that we have to deal with. And, you know, debates and sound bites on television try to put you in a box to give a simple answer to a very complex problem. And Barack Obama is very honest to try not to do that. And so his authenticity, his inspiration, his ability to bring people in, and I look at it like this. Whether you support him on every position, whether it be Iraq or Palestine or, you know, guns or, you know, whatever the issue is, if you don't agree with him, that's fine. But you have to, if you're a Democrat or if you believe in our democratic process in America and that everybody should vote and participate in our democracy, you should support Barack Obama. Because there's one thing is clear, is that people that have never been engaged in the political process before, people that never felt a reason to get involved, people that never thought that it mattered or never thought that they could do anything about it, are coming to the table in droves. And this means so much to have so many people participate in our democracy. And we should be proud of that, that we're finally at the point now that we may get nearly 50% of the registered voters in America to actually vote in an election. You know, people don't really realize that we don't ever really get the 50% of our electorate that actually votes. But because of Barack Obama's candidacy, people are coming to the process. And so if you're a citizen of this country and you think voting matters and everybody should vote, Barack Obama is a candidate that can bring people to the table that may have felt disenfranchised and felt like the process didn't belong to them. And you got to be proud of that. And that's the biggest thing above all else of what gets me excited, because it means we get better government when more people participate and more people are paying attention. That's what's exciting.
Did you see his speech this morning?
I did.
It was masterful.
Yes, it was. It was incredible.
It was. And I got to tell you, I watched that speech this morning, and I saw some history being made. It was an incredible speech. Trying to put the man in a box, you know, over the reverend and all that. Maybe my listeners agree or don't agree. I don't care. He explained everything in a reasonable and cogent way. You're just as good a speaker as he is. You are.
Well, thank you.
I really that's one of the things I love about Barack Obama. He can express himself so well, and he's so sincere about it. And you I can tell you got a passion for it.
Well, I do. And the speech he gave today is the kind of speech that we never hear politicians ever give. I mean, that was literally from the heart. It was very personal and very authentic. And you know, it wasn't done by a speechwriter. It wasn't done by, you know, somebody on staff. That was Barack's personal words of how he thinks about this situation, how he thinks about race in America. And we can't deny that, you know, we have to give him credit for his experience, one. And number two, like he said at the end of the speech, we truly have a choice. We can either replay the reruns of Reverend on TV saying those things, or we can realize that this is a hurdle that we've come to, that we've climbed over to some degree, that we've turned a page. We've not finished the book on race and class and gender in America, but with Barack Obama, we've definitely turned the page. And we can move on now to begin to reflect on how we address the major issues that impact every last one of us. The war in Iraq, healthcare, corporations taking our jobs overseas. All of those things are incredibly important to everyone, regardless of your race or your class or your gender. And he laid out a speech that was really, really heartfelt and really, really specific of how he's been dealing with this his entire life. That's an experience that I can't share, that many people can't share. You know, being, you know, born of a white mother from Canvas and a black father from Kenya, you know, and growing up in the United States of America, being raised by his grandparents, and understanding what his grandmother was concerned about in her day, growing up in the 30s, 40s, and 50s about African Americans. And so I think we all have to feel very, very proud the fact that the speech was made, that the statement was made, but more importantly, that Barack Obama is asking us to make a choice. Do we want to continue to wallow in the frustrations of racism in the past, or would we like to turn the page and move and address the issues that really matter to us all? And I think that was very clear.
You brought up that you can't share some of it. Can you share what he was talking about when he mentioned the barbershop?
Yes, very much so. I mean,
That affected me,
yeah,
when he talked about that.
It is. It's you know, again, he's right. You don't talk about it in all company, but you know, in the barbershops, you know, people talk about how, you know, they feel that immigrants are taking their jobs, African Americans in particular. They talk about that there's a ceiling that they can never pass because, you know, they're not white or somebody won't give them an opportunity. Those are things that people really, really feel, and that's why you can't really discount whether it's real or perceived, because it's what people feel. And we have to find a way to really focus on those things that are actually happening to people, that are problematic, that are not good, and correct those. But then we also need to move beyond the rhetorical, made-up circumstances that are not what's happening to people. And there's a lot to wrestle with in that. And I do identify with the barbershop and what people talk about in church or when they're sitting around the coffee table, you know, watching a Super Bowl or playing cards or whatever whatever you're doing. And I think everybody has that identified experience of what happens in quiet company that doesn't ever happen when you're in public space or in mixed company. And we all need to wrestle with that, and we all need to figure out, you know, am I being complicit in this situation, or am I being a part of the solution? And I think Barack Obama is calling for all of us and asking for all of us to work to be a part of the solution.
Well, understandably, I thought when he talked about that barbershop moment, and I know everybody's picked out something out of that speech or whatever, but it hit me all of a sudden that here we are, myself and the whole black community, we're trying to look at this campaign. I've been trying to say, would you please forget the race issue?
Right.
Would you please just forget it? Would you?
Right.
And we all want to become colorblind and all that.
Yep.
And yet, we have to deal with those barbershop problems.
Yes.
So on the one hand, we're saying let's, but we've got to bring those problems
right.
in and solve
right.
them. So
right.
to get to ask the American public, it's very difficult.
Yes, it is very difficult, and I think it's just going to continue to take time. I mean, we just got to keep moving one by one, person by person, and really trying to open the door and open the process to have dialogue. And I think Barack Obama has given us a reason to do what we're doing now, is to have this kind of dialogue about race, class, and gender in America and what it means to people, and how do we get better for it, and how do we be better for it. And we can't discount people's experiences. We have to understand them and figure out how do we help them to move beyond it. How do we continue to turn the page?
Somebody on the chat room is asking me to please say your name again. They got in on halfway through. It's Anton Gunn. Anton is running for the House of Representatives in the state of South Carolina. He's been heavily involved in the Barack Obama campaign. And Anton is a very well-spoken gentleman that I think you're going to hear a lot more of. I think you've got a good chance of winning your race this year.
Well, I hope so. I'm going to need a lot of support, a lot of help. I'm really building a community. My campaign is not the committee to elect or Gunn for the House or anything along those lines. It's the community to elect Anton Gunn. And that's the whole focus of what I'm doing, is really trying to build a community of supporters, of you know, voters, all kinds of people that are willing to help and be a part of what I'm trying to build. And so, you know, if anybody wants to find out more, how they can get involved, even from afar, you can visit me at www.electantongunn.com and learn more about me, the community that I live in, some of the issues that impact that community, and how we all can work together to make positive change in South Carolina, but in our nation, because we need people that are willing to roll up their sleeves and put down the partisan divide and stop letting barriers and labels keep us from dialoguing. Because I truly believe that all of us probably have more in common than we do have that separates us, but we never really take the time to have the discussion. And I think that's what Barack Obama was trying to explain in his speech today, is that we need to have the discussion, because we'll see that NAFTA is very much important to African Americans, just as it is to everybody in the white community. That the war in Iraq is very much important to African Americans, just like it's people into the white community. And if we really get rid of the racial framework of our lens, we'll see that these problems impact us all, and we need a leader that's willing to see how they impact us individually, but willing to work together to solve them because they impact us all.
Anton, one thing I wish for you, and I don't know what's going on in your local campaign. I would hope that somehow, some way, that you'd be able to have a local TV debate with your opponent, because nobody at a debate is going to choose another person over you in this campaign.
Well, I really appreciate you saying that, and dialogue is what's so important to me, and I think campaigns need to be more about having conversation and dialogue rather than sound bites, because the more conversation you have, the more you see really that we're all complex, and we got a lot of stuff that we got to get done.
Well, Anton, I wish you the best of luck. I hope you win. You folks, you're going to hear a lot more from this gentleman.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
I've enjoyed talking to you. We'll be keeping an eye on you.
That's right. Let's hope the Buckeyes play the Gamecocks in the bowl game again this coming year.
Yeah, I would like that.
Yeah, that'd be good. We can get together then.
Yeah. Anton, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Anton Gunn, and do be sure and go to that. Go to the website. We'll repeat it several times throughout the broadcast here today. Anton at Elect Anton Gunn. That's G-U-N-N, two N's, .com. And what I said is right. He's not here anymore, but you wouldn't want to go up into a debate against this guy. You wouldn't. He's personable. He's likable. Knows what he's talking about. Have you heard anybody more well-spoken? Anybody. So here we're going to pause for about 60 seconds, and we'll be back after about 60 seconds, okay? Don't go away. You're listening to The Guy James Show.
There's a place where a total stranger will give their blood to save your life. There's a place where someone you never knew will save your child from drowning. A place where people will give you food and shelter after a flood. There's a place where, when you need it most, someone will reach out their hand, put it across your shoulder and say, "Everything's going to be okay." That place is called America, where we look out for each other. And it's up to us to keep it that way. When you help the American Red Cross, you help America. Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org today.
We're back once again live from the Omni Shoreham here at the Campaign for America's Future Conference this year. Another success. They've all been successful. They've gotten bigger and better every year. We talked to Robert Borsage about it, how we don't have any presidential candidates here this year, but and no slight to the presidential campaigners, but we really haven't needed them here this year. This is more about us. This is more about the people. This is more about liberal organizations and progressive organizations. Roger, I use that word liberal a lot. I call myself. I don't run from it.
Yeah.
We have with us the co-director of this great campaign for America's Future, Roger Hickey, right now. Roger, welcome to the program.
I thank you very much.
Another great conference.
Yeah, we're very excited. And I think the people here at this conference are particularly excited because there's a chance that the country's really going to change. You know, we've been working on this for a long, long time. And we've been in the wilderness for a long, long time. And this is going to be a change election. You can feel it. So we're feeling like we can go on to the second stage, which is starting to deliver for the American people.
Get them elected and then hold their feet to the fire.
That's
right. And it's probably easier to get them elected than hold their feet to the fire.
We've always said that changing the government is just a step along the way to changing the economy of the country so it works for working people. And there's a lot of big changes we've got to make right off the bat. Getting out of Iraq, getting health care for everybody in America, and getting this economy to work right. And it's been proven time and time again, if there's a Democratic president and he doesn't have the kind of pressure, he or she doesn't have the kind of outside pressure that Roosevelt had in the days of the New Deal, pushing him along, things don't change.
Well, change is the word this year, and conferences like this, this conference in particular, like no other, what a lot of people at home may not understand, this isn't just a group where everybody gets together and talks a little bit and gets a few ideas. These people go home on fire from a conference like this and just work in campaigns and getting out the progressive ideas.
Yeah. You know, we had a press conference where we sort of arrayed some of the groups that are doing grassroots organizing before the election. They're reaching out to voters, they're taking voters to the polls, they're getting people registered, and they're giving people a reason to vote, a nonpartisan reason that'll probably help the Democrats more than the Republicans. If you're for health care for all and that's the reason you're going to go vote, you're likely to vote Democratic. But it's an independent campaign to get people involved in the political system, and it's going to be huge this year. There's going to be a huge turnout this year. You've already seen it in the primaries, and that is very exciting for our democracy. That shows that if we make a political change, we can also make real policy changes after that.
Indeed, and one of the heartening parts about it, and I mentioned this to Bob, lots of young people here this year, more than I have seen, especially in the exposition hall. I've seen many, many, many young people, and that's the secret. I mean, the old timers like me, we're about done with our, well, hopefully not about done, but we've got to turn it over to the youngsters now. And for a long time, I worried whether or not there was anybody to turn it over to, but they're there and they've got their hands out ready to take the baton right now and run with it, I think.
You know, at some point, the young people in this country just looked around and saw who was in charge of the country and thought about their lives going forward. They looked at the Iraq War and what a mess that was, and they just decided, well, we've got to get involved. We've got to be engaged in the politics and irreverent about criticizing our leaders if they need to be criticized. So it's a very exciting kind of political cultural revolution that's happening right now among young people. It's great.
Well, it is in light of, in particular, I said for a long time that maybe they wouldn't get so involved in this particular election this year. Well, the war is not a big issue because we don't have a draft. Well, it turns out that's not what we needed. We just needed to get the word out. We've got some great young activists that have been working, gentlemen that we just interviewed a minute ago, a lot of young activists out working hard to, and you know, maybe people like me, maybe I can't convince young people to get out. Maybe it takes their own. Someone is, you know, plant that seed with somebody and let them go grow that themselves.
Yeah, although I find that, like in the session we had this morning where we talked about the days of Martin Luther King and his dynamic and often critical relationship with Lyndon Johnson, I've found that the young people want to learn from the past. So we don't repeat the mistakes of the past. One young person said to me, you know, this is an exciting political year. It's like you guys had 1968, and this is our 1968. Well, I knew what he meant, but I sure hope it works out better for them than 68 did for us.
The streets out front are a whole lot more peaceful, and I hope they will be
in
Denver.
And the country got a whole lot more polarized, unfortunately, back then. We've managed to go through an opposition to the war in Iraq where the country's turned against the war without polarizing, without splitting in two. And that really bodes well for the future.
I worried about it for a long time when the war first started. I thought it might do that, but I think people from both parties now have had enough. There's your holdouts. There's some hardcore that are – there's your John McCain's and people that are going to hang in there and want to fight this war from now till the end of time. But I've seen us as a country come together, and that's very heartening to me.
Yeah, it's very true.
Roger, I want to thank you so much for being on the program. I want to thank you so much for working so hard on this conference.
Guy, I want to thank you for your program. You're communicating every day, and we really appreciate that.
Well, we're interested in what happens to America. And,
Amen.
You know, they call us progressive liberals like we're not patriotic, like we don't care what happens. That's why we do this. Love the country. We love the flag. We love the patriotism, and that's why we do this. Otherwise, you could take a hike and do something else.
Amen. And I'm glad you're doing what you're doing. Thank you.
Roger, thank you. Roger's the co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, and I want to thank him so much for being on the program. We're going to break for news coming up in just a couple of minutes. We've got the Labor Radio news coming up at the top of the hour. Do want to thank everybody so much for being with us today. A tremendous group here at this conference right now. I see John Conyers at the moment being interviewed right across from me. We've had Norman Lear standing over here still. We've got people, lots of people of note. Spoke to Phil Donahue last night, quite a little bit. Saw Phil again this morning. Very engaging gentleman. I didn't ask him about if he's still for Ralph Nader. I did not ask him. I'm not sure. So, anyway, and we see our friend Peter B. Collins walking around. Peter B. has had a long haul here at the conference. He's been filling in for Tom Hartman's show and then doing his own. And believe me, doing 6 hours in a day is a tough, tough, tough job, a very tough, tough, tough job. So, anyway, Peter comes here from the San Francisco Bay Area right now. He's formerly from Ohio. I'm always talking about how I'm originally from Ohio. Peter B. Collins is formerly from Ohio. Actually, he started in radio pretty close to where I started from radio. So, in fact, he's just walking by this way, and we got about a minute till the top of the hour. Peter B. Collins, welcome to the Guy James Show.
Well, thank you, Guy. How are you?
Lots of our listeners listen to you, and I was just telling them what yeoman's duty you've had to do here at the conference.
Well, I need to apologize because earlier this morning I was describing the bizarre scene on Fox News before they introduced the Barack Obama speech where two white anchors and Bill Kristol were discussing race relations in America. And I just yelled out, I couldn't control myself and kind of uttered a scream that went on every program here at Radio Row. So I'm busy mending fences, and if I blew in on you, I apologize.
Well, you're doing what, 6 hours a day at the conference?
Yeah.
That's tough.
Well, we got to take back America. I mean, a lot of people work 11 hours a day, guys, so I don't feel sorry for myself.
well, anyway, I congratulate you on that. 6 hours, 6 hours is a long haul on radio. A lot of people think, well, you stick a microphone down there and you just talk for 6 hours. It's not a big deal.
It's what I love to do, and this is a chance to connect with a lot of important people. I talked to John Conyers today, and also to... Norman Lear was here. I mean, you've had a lot of these same folks, and it's great to be able to spend time with them and get them to talk about the important issues we're fighting.
Well, this is it today, right? You don't have to. You're heading back home to tomorrow?
No, tomorrow actually I'll be here. We're going to do a show from a studio here in Washington, and then I fly back on Thursday.
Local TV or radio station?
No, we're using the studio that Bill Press originates from.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And
he's over.
Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast, but
yeah, I was trying
don't
to think
come by.
What organ? Huh?
I was giving the address, but didn't want people.
Yeah,
to
don't
drop
need
by.
No, you don't need to show. we're going to pause for news at the top of the hour. You're listening to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network, and we'll be back. And I expect you will be as well. Thank you.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Tension is growing in the American Axle strike as dozens of GM plants remain closed by the UAW strike at the auto parts maker. Over the weekend, two people were arrested for disorderly conduct on the picket lines in Detroit. Bill Alford is vice president of UAW Local 235. He says morale is high on the picket lines, but the company is at times taunting the picketers.
You got, you know, people trying to come out here and picket in peace, and they're being taunted and things like that, you know, and you know, all my picketers are just trying to come out here. You know, they're hardworking people. They work 9 to 5, you know, and they come out here and picket, and then you got the company, you know, does tactics, things that they know that would probably incite people and make them upset.
3,600 workers went on an unfair labor practices strike February 26th after the company refused to provide detailed information needed to bargain over American Axle's demand that wages be cut in half and future retiree pensions and health care benefits be ended. Alford says the strike is supported by the local communities and the strikers are grateful.
We really appreciate all the support that we're getting from the communities, and thank you to everyone that's come down and bought a little packet of money or a box of food or a busload of people to help walk with us. I want to thank everyone. It's just really touching.
Dock workers and shipping line representatives have begun early contract negotiations in hopes of avoiding a sequel to the crippling 2002 port lockout. Jesse Russell reports.
Negotiations on a contract that expires on July 1st have already begun between the International Longshore and Warehouse Union and the Pacific Maritime Association. The union represents nearly 15,000 West Coast dock workers, and the association represents the 72 shipping companies that use the 29 ports stretching from San Diego to upstate Washington. The two sides agreed to early negotiations in an attempt to avoid a repeat of the 2002 lockouts that crippled U.S. shipping for 10 days. The union is hoping to secure better safety and pollution regulations at the ports, as well as wage increases. 11% of the United States' gross domestic product flows through those ports. The 2002 lockout caused an estimated $15.6 billion in losses and ended when President George W. Bush ordered the ports to reopen. Here's today's economic report. New Orleans is still struggling more than 2 years since Hurricane Katrina hit. A new report has found that an estimated 1 in 25 residents of the Crescent City is homeless, nearly double the pre-Katrina count, according to homeless advocacy group Unity. That means 4% of New Orleans' population is homeless, while most cities have homeless rates of less than 1%. The next closest rate is Atlanta, with 1.4%.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show. Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Yes, indeed. We are back once again live from the Omnishorum Hotel at the annual Take Back America Conference. A great success once again. I'm enjoying this conference a good deal. And my compadre, Mark Levine's... Well, he's standing over there doing a little TV work right now. We've got the Code Pink people walking around singing to us, serenading us. So if you hear music in the background, you'll know what that is. It is my great pleasure right now to have a gentleman on to talk about something, as you all know, is something that just ruffles my feathers a lot. And I've got Nick Neihardt right now, and he's president and CEO of Public Campaign. And Nick, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here, Guy.
I hope you can stay for 3 or 4 hours, because this is a subject that is near and dear to a lot of people's hearts, and it is about financing of these campaigns. And oh my God, this year, it's out of control.
Well, the records are being set once again, and one good thing is that a lot of more small donors, people giving $25, $50, $10, $5, are involved. But the scary part is that the big money has increased even more. And so while we've seen hundreds of thousands of people give what they can, even if that's a small amount, to move some campaigns forward, the big money has increased even faster. And so in many cases, the small donors are a smaller share of the pie than the bigger ones. And the cost of running for office goes up and up and up. And in a private financing system, it simply means the candidates have to rely more and more on the deep pocket interests to finance their campaigns.
But, of course, just because they take a bunch of bundled money or money from the big pharma or somebody, that doesn't mean they're going to reciprocate in any way, shape, or form.
Well, we could go on for a long time about how long they'll keep getting that money if they vote against that money's interest. But what I think is interesting to talk about, more interesting, is if you wanted to design a system from scratch, what would you want to have happen? And there is a system we call clean elections or fair elections that tells the candidates, we're going to make it so the incentives for winning are all about spending more time with voters and less time with the people who can write you a big check.
Well, let me tell you where I think we should start. And then you can pick this apart and tell me how crazy I am. Maybe you probably heard this before. I want no money in political campaigns. That may be impractical. I want the local newspapers and TV and radios to give all of our candidates some equal time. I want them to go door to door. I want them to do it that way. I don't know how much time we'll get the networks or anybody to give them. After all, we do own the airwaves, so we can demand that, I think. And I don't want any money.
Uh-huh.
How crazy am I?
Well, I think sometimes a candidate wants to describe what they're about in their own way, and they want contact with voters. They want to have events. They want to explain in their own brochures, their own ads, what they're about. And I think the voters ought to have a chance to hear what the candidates have to say about themselves. I think the problem is when it's so expensive to do that, and you tell candidates, oh, and by the way, you can collect money at up to $2,300 a pop, the incentive system is all wrong. So in an alternative system, what we call a fair elections or a clean election system, and this is actually up and running in a number of states right now. Hundreds of candidates have used this system to get elected. Candidates are told the way to win is to get a large number of small contributions, and you pull those together. So, for instance, for Governor Napolitano in Arizona, she had to gather something over 4,000 $5 contributions. She turned those in. She received a lump sum from the state's publicly financed election fund, and that's how much she had to run for office. Now, if her opponent had taken that deal, they'd have a level playing field. And that happened the second time she ran using this. But the first time, the opponent said, no, I'm going to keep raising money. And so once he hit what she had gotten from the public fund and went over that, she got matching funds, or what some people call fair fight funds, to keep pace. So she kept the level playing field. But here's the thing. It meant all the time she was going after voters, her opponent was going out of state, raising big money, or just catering to the few people who could write big checks. And in the end, she ran a more people-oriented campaign and won. So I think if you sat back and said, what do we want the incentive system to be? We want it for candidates to pay attention to voters. That's what we'd want first and foremost, and that's what the system that is up and running now in 7 states and 2 cities, that's what the system does.
What hope do you have? The people that are benefiting from this, the candidates, they're the ones feeding from this trough that they've made, and they're the ones making the rules. How do we wean them off?
Well, we've got a ways to go, but let me tell you a dirty little secret about this, is getting so the candidates don't like it either, because they're spending 7 days a week locked up in a little box making phone calls to people they've never met before to say, hey, would you give me some money? And they certainly feel the quid pro quo. They know if they don't answer the questions right on the phone, that person might not give them money. So they may have to please that person. They don't like being indebted to people. And let me give you an example. Senator Dick Durbin, the Senate majority leader, is assistant majority leader, sorry, second most powerful person in the Senate, is now leading the way to install a fair election system in Congress. And he simply says the current system is unsustainable. So much of what drives him up there is thinking about money that he just wants out of that. He wants to think about his voters and thinks about the issues he cares most about. And he's got a Republican co-sponsor, Arlen Specter from Pennsylvania, to be a lead co-sponsor along with him in the Fair Elections Now Act. So right now, even the candidates at that level, with all the millions of dollars you need to raise to be a federally elected official, are saying, enough, let's do it a different way. And they'll take a fair fight. They'll spot their opponent a level playing field and say, let's fight it out with the voters rather than spend all their time raising money. Now, that's not a majority. We're not going to go out and win this next week. But I think beginning in 2009, you're going to see a real fight to change the way we finance congressional campaigns.
Has McCain-Feingold been a total failure?
Well, you know, I think the fact that huge corporate interests and very deep pocket interests can't write large checks to the parties is probably a good thing. But I think at the retail level of politicking, not much has changed. And the money still finds a way to the candidates. And what you really need to do is break the link between candidates and the need to get huge amounts of money from deep pocketed interests. Until you tackle that, you really haven't tackled reform.
We have people. I'm originally from Ohio, and I seem to know a lot about Ohio politics. We have people now running for state representative, spending as much money as it used to cost for a Senate campaign in Ohio.
Right.
It's just completely off the charts.
It's skyrocketing, and the amount of money it cost to run 20 or 30 years ago. Well, put it this way, if you're not for public financing, if you weren't for it back then, you might be for it now because it costs so much more to run. But wait another, if you're not for it yet, wait another 4 years or 6 years because it's going to cost twice again what it does now. So there is no end to this cycle. It's like an arms race. And until you say, hey, we're bankrupting ourselves, buying arms and endangering the world, until you give up this current system, you're not going to have an answer. I'll tell you one thing. We're finding increasingly a number of big political donors, not just the incumbents, but now political donors are supporting this publicly financed alternative, the Clean Elections or Fair Elections alternative. And I spoke with one gentleman a few years ago about it. I said, so why are you supporting public financing now? And he said, well, used to be good government cost me about $5,000 in contributions per year. Now it's more like $50,000. So even the contributors are saying, you know, I just write bigger checks every year. I'm not getting a better United States or a better state out of it. I'd like to out of this system also.
Mm. I think one of the tragedies of the system we have now is that we're losing a lot of good candidates, people that would make remarkable candidates for office, and they look at the monumental job
right
in front of them raising money, and no, I can't
right
do it.
Well, you're absolutely right. If, you know, when people screen candidates early on, the first question is, how much money can you give? So you're either rich, or how much money can you raise? So you're either an excellent fundraiser with a big network or a person with their own deep pockets. And if you opened up the system to say, all right, anybody who can get a lot of people to each give them $5, that will qualify you to run. If you have a big network of people, that ought to count for something. You allow all sorts of people with lots of leadership and good judgment to offer this country to run for office and run successfully. In fact, when people say, what are the changes you see in Arizona or Maine, where hundreds of candidates have used the system to get elected, they say different kinds of people can run for office. So you may have farmers or school teachers or social workers or small business people running for office and holding office, and they bring a different perspective to a state legislature. Let me give you an example. There was a woman in Maine, Deborah Simpson, who'd never thought she could run for office because it would cost a fair amount of money, and she was a single mom, low-wage worker, worked as a waitress in a diner, trying to take care of her child. And then when Clean Elections, as they call it in Maine, came along, she was able to run for office. And she was a community activist. She knew lots of people and inspired people. Well, she won, and now she sits on a committee that helps write the laws that govern what happens to children who don't have a lot of assets behind them. So, you know, think about that. Instead of the province of people who are well-networked financially, all of a sudden you have real people dealing with real-life situations, making the laws and making decisions about how the state's going to be governed with respect to those issues.
Going back to our beginnings as a country, has it always been like this? Not from what I can see. Didn't we originally maybe intend for the butcher, baker, candlestick maker to be representatives, or was it always for the elite?
Well, you know, I got to tell you, if you look at the history of election laws, it started out with a lot of ideals, but laws that didn't really add up to those ideals. So it's always been beneficial to have a lot of money You know, in the old days, you had to own property, you had to be a male, you had to be white, and so on. But I think one of the good things is that we've seen movement towards democracy on so many fronts over the past 200-plus years of this nation's history. And I think the next big step is publicly financed elections.
Public financed elections, and for me, I want to put a little trailer on with that. I want term limits as well. I would like to see that. You mentioned level the playing field for a lot of people. I had a gentleman on the program earlier today. His name is Anton Gunn. Anton is running for the State House of Representatives in South Carolina. One of the most well-spoken gentlemen that I have ever listened to. I guarantee you, if he has financial level playing field, that he will defeat anybody that comes up. But again, money.
Yep.
Money's the thing.
Yep.
I mean,
well, there you go. He needs to get out who he is to the voters, and he can't do that without money. But suppose he could pull together 25 people at a house party down the street from where he lives, in another neighborhood, another side of town, another 25 people, and so on, each giving just $5. He can run a fully funded campaign for that kind of money. And there are a lot more people who can bundle people instead of bundling big checks out there. And so you'll see people like him able to run and win. The other thing is voters get a great deal out of this, because it means for $5 you can sponsor somebody and be a big part of getting them to run a financially solvent and competitive campaign. Right now, you have to be able to write a $250 check or a $500 check or a $1,000 check to really help someone run for office and be financially competitive. This gives that writer that privilege back to ordinary citizens.
We've seen a lot of that this year. The small campaigns and the small contributions. The Obama campaign really stands out this year.
Well, sure. I think he said 90% of his contributors are giving small $100 or less campaigns. But you flip that, and the bigger campaign check writers are actually contributing. The people who write $1,000 checks or more are contributing the majority of Obama's money. So that small group is actually propelling him further financially than that much larger group of ordinary citizens who are writing the smaller checks. So we want a system that leverages those small dollar contributions so the big dollar money isn't necessary.
Well, I certainly hope that your campaign continues on with a success. How many years have you been at it?
Well, the organization was founded about 11 years ago, and there were a group of us around the country working on the first state victories before that. So Maine, by vote of the people, put the system in place in 1996, although the first year it went into effect was the year 2000. So say around 10 years or so, the system has been really out there. But, you know, it's popular that when pollsters ask people, would you support a new system under which candidates who show a broad base of support qualify for public funds on the condition they take no other private money and agree to a spending limit, that gets about 70% support all over the place. It gets support from strong majority support from Democrats, independents, Republicans, conservatives, liberals, and so on. So it's a popular idea. The current system's just getting worse, and to be honest, I think eventually we are going to switch to a system of public financing or have that alternative, a voluntary system, so people who want to run this way can.
It's something that truly should be completely bipartisan. I can't see that one side or the other has a whole lot to gain from not having that way.
That's right, and I think the way to look at this is not right versus left or conservative versus liberal. It's top versus bottom. It's grassroots versus entrenched power.
Who are you working hardest on, the people or the politicians?
Well, we're working on both. If we get the people, we'll get the politicians.
That's true. That's usually the way it works out. Nick, I want to thank you very much for stopping by the program. I could talk to you for a long, 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 long time.
Well, invite us back. We have more to say.
Please do leave one of your cards and stuff. We will like to have you on the
program
again.
Thanks very much.
Get back home. Thank you. Nick Neihardt, President and CEO of Public Campaign. And Nick, let me ask you, a website.
Yeah, www.publiccampaign.org. And the trick is, spell public campaign as one word with one C. And you come to that website, publiccampaign.org, with just one C, and you can learn all about clean elections.
All right, I got it here. Yeah, publiccampaign, leave the one C out, .org.
That's right.
And that'll get you there. That's something, and thanks again, Nick. Thanks very much.
Great.
something that hey, it's bursting at the seams. Something's got to give. If this election doesn't prove it, I don't know when it will. It's got to give. And, you know, we've been on a campaign for this for a long, long, long time, talked about it, and it's something that's, well, it will until we get it straightened out. And I think we will. I think we will. We're going to pause for a quick break right now. Thanks for being with us here in the Guy James Show. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Take it away, Bob.
Still looking for weapons of mass destruction? Concerned about the future of the Supreme Court? You want to know how government bureaucrats are changing Social Security, overtime pay, or the environment? Maybe you just want to know if the president's lying to you, or when our troops in Iraq can finally come home. I'm Mark Levine. I've got the inside scoop. When you want to know what's going on inside the Beltway, you need a Beltway insider. Someone who's worked in the government and still has sources willing to give you all the news from Washington the government does not want you to know. So for lively debate, reasoned opinion, detailed analysis of history and policy, or just a point of view you don't hear expressed in the mainstream media, tune in to the Inside Scoop. Feel free to call in too. Agree or disagree. All opinions are welcome. It just might make you think. That's the Inside Scoop, weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern, 1 Central, 11 o'clock Pacific, right here on the Head On Radio Network.
I never thought my daughter and I would ever think the same thing is cool.
At home, my boys are like a wrecking ball. But when they volunteer, they're actually shaping things up.
Hey, they plant a tree at the local park. Clean the place up.
She makes new friends. She has a great time.
My son loves that he's contributing.
These are nice kids.
The Are You Into It volunteer program is a great way for you and your kids to make a difference in the community while making friends. So, if you're into it, or you think your kid might be, call 4-H toll-free at 1-888-77-YOUTH. Or visit our website at www.areyouintoit.com.
Can't get him to clean his room, but he loves volunteering.
A public service message brought to you by 4-H, the Cooperative Extension System, and the Ad Council.
Okay, we are back, and thank you for joining us here today, everybody. This is the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network. So good to have all of you with us today. We are with literally thousands of political activists here at the Campaign for America's Future annual conference, and we've had some great guests. There's a lot of really interesting people here. I did mention a while ago we saw Norman Lear here. He's the guest of honor, I guess, tonight for his Lifetime Achievement Award in Progressive Causes. And yes, he did wear that little hat. I always wondered whether he wore that hat everywhere, and he does. But I've looked for one and I can't find one anyplace, so don't expect to see me in one of those little hats. Anyway, we have a guest with us right now. We have Dave Donnelly, and Dave is with us to we're going to continue on this conversation talking about money. I like to talk about money, but I as you well know, don't like the way the money goes in the political campaigns and how money drives everything in it now, and it's getting to the point where it's just completely out of control. Dave Donnelly, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Guy.
Tell us a little bit about your organization.
Sure. Public Campaign Action Fund is an organization that works on two things. We work to promote public financing of elections. I think your previous guest, my colleague Nick Neihardt, was probably discussing some of the success that we've had with public financing laws at the state level and the work that we're doing around the country on that issue. But we also work to hold candidates accountable. Politicians take money from lots of different places, and they oftentimes will vote the way that their contributors want rather than what's in the best interest of their constituents. And so when we see a politician who's against reform and is taking money from wealthy interests and doing favors for them, we like to point that out right in the context of elections so that voters know whether the candidates that they're voting for are on their side or whether they're on the side of the contributors. So we do some very hard-edged political work to point out who's for reform and who's against it.
Making candidates accountable, what a novel idea. A lot of them don't feel very accountable, do they?
Well, they're accountable, but they're accountable to their cash constituents, not their voting constituents. And so what we want to do is to put a little pressure on them to show that reform, that voters care about cleaning up the political system and that they want campaign finance reform. And only then, when members of Congress lose an election because they've been too close to big money interests, only then do you see some corrective changes in Congress. If you look at the 2006 elections, there are a number of members of Congress that either lost their elections or frankly, went to jail before they even could be voted on because of their connections to lobbyists and big money. And that led to a number of different ethics and lobbying reform type measures. We think we need to turn up the heat even more to get them to deal with public financing of elections.
That helps your organization, does it not? When some of these rats get caught in a trap, your Jack Abramoff type scandal, your Duke Cunningham type thing, your Bob Ney type thing?
Yeah. Well, we certainly never hope for scandals.
No.
But we certainly know what to do with them when they come. We want to, you know, that's certainly what makes voters very angry about the political system. They feel like that elected officials are either working only to feather their own nests or to help out their contributors and not necessarily to look out for the people back on Main Street. And so we think that by putting reform in that context, by talking about the need to get money out of politics or reduce the influence of money in politics because it's going to impact people's lives, we may have a better chance to get a better health care system. We may have a chance to reduce energy prices if big money from those interests didn't control the debate so much. But we think by turning up the heat on candidates on those issues connected to money and politics will help in the long run.
How many people in your organization?
We have about 15 staff overall, many of whom work on the policy end of things and pursuing public financing at the state level. And then we have about 125,000 online members around the country who are active in their own communities to advance public financing or to work to hold candidates accountable.
So to keep people accountable, you have to do a lot of research.
We do.
You have to follow voting records and patterns extremely closely. You have a regular research staff, or do you?
We do have a research staff. We have three people on a research staff. It's very easy to find out where the money is coming from. There are some great resources out there. OpenSecrets.org, which is the Center for Responsive Politics. It's also relatively easy to find out where the votes are.
I read Open Secrets for fun.
That's good. You're a man after my own heart there. But you can see where the votes are. You know, the Congress actually has the voting records posted on their website. But to link the two together takes the work, and then to link up the money and the votes together, and then to deliver that information to voters in districts around the country, that's the work that we do. So we take the information that's available, we combine it, and we tell a story that matters to regular people.
And you see some real patterns develop.
Absolutely, we see patterns. We see, the telecommunications company in this last go round in telecommunications immunity bill. We see money flowing to those that vote to give the those telecom companies retroactive immunity, and those who to vote, you know, to hold them accountable, hold the telecommunications accountable, don't get very much money from the telecom companies. We see that on energy policy with oil and gas money and nuclear money. We see that on any number of public policy issues. You can really track where a candidate is going to, where a politician will vote based on who their biggest contributors are.
And it's always deny, deny, deny. No, of course I take money from the big companies. They're allowed to contribute just as you are, but there is no quid pro quo. I look at my record, blah, blah, blah. I live in Florida now, and I don't want to mention any names. Well, I have mentioned the name on the show, but anyway, we have a governor that took a considerable amount of money in the last campaign, and I'm just doing this for instance, from the insurance industry. And it was brought up in a debate, how much money you've taken from the insurance industry. Well, of course I've taken money from the insurance industry, but I am using that money, and we've heard this one before, I am using that money to fight for you, for legislation that will help you in the fight against some of the wrongs that the insurance companies have in the hurricane and all that kind of stuff. I probably don't have to tell you how many insurance reforms have taken place since that election.
Yeah.
None.
Yeah.
Zero. And yet we hear that story over and over
again.
Well,
I tell you, I firmly believe that there are a whole lot of good people caught in an awful system. In order to achieve anything in politics, to move up through the ranks, if you're ambitious and you want to run for an office or move up to the next higher office, you're going to have to become a good fundraiser. To become a good fundraiser, you spend a lot of time talking to a very small number of people, the people who actually have the ability to write a $2,000 check or a larger check to a candidate. You spend all your time talking to those people. You're not talking to the people who have very little money to give. And it's just human nature. Of course, what you learn about issues, of course, what you, you know, the opinions that you develop over time on issues that are new to you or that are emerging, are going to be defined by who you're talking to. And if you're not talking to average voters, if you're not talking to people who are losing their homes, for example, in this mortgage crisis, you know, let me just give you an example. How many senators do you think in the U.S. Senate, are actively raising money from those people who are losing their homes? Or are they raising money from the banks and the mortgage lenders? You know, is that going to change the way, is that going to change the information that they get? It's just common sense. It's not that we have awful people in elective office, it's that we have an awful system. And I think we need to free our elected officials from this unending fundraising. It's really, you know, unsustainable. We can't keep going on this way.
You're more generous than I am. I don't always put it that way.
Well, 99% of them are good people. I know there's some bad apples.
There's some
awful people. Yeah.
But you're right. They are caught in a system that is of their own making.
And some of them defend it, you know, vigorously, and that's wrong. You know, Mitch McConnell, the senator from Kentucky, defends the system up and down and thinks it's free speech, thinks it's the American way. I disagree. I think that the ability to buy an election is not free speech. I think that's paid speech. I don't think that's right. That's not the American way.
And it's also such a huge advantage for incumbency.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What is it, 90% to get reelected?
Or more in some elections, yeah.
That's not fair. Yeah, not fair at all. I'm told that you took part in the election in Maine.
I did, yeah, when I was young and foolish. I ran a ballot question in Maine in 1996. It seems like a lifetime ago that passed the first system of full public financing in the country, which created the clean election system there. There are people like Deborah Simpson, who's a state rep there, who decided, yeah, I want to run for office now. And there's some incredible stories of people who would never have offered themselves up for public service. That if you take the money equation out of the game, decide, you know, running for office isn't all that bad because I get to talk to my neighbors, I get to talk to my, to the citizens in my district, and I get to, you know, weigh what they want me to do, and I don't have to weigh, you know, is it going to impact my fundraising? That's, you know, it frees up our elected officials, both those that are in office and those who want to be in office, to do the right thing.
Well, as I mentioned to Nick, our previous guest, one of the tragedies of this whole thing is there's a lot of really great people that were great leaders that we're missing out on account of this.
And think about what we need right now as great leaders. I mean, to get us out of this mess in Iraq, to deal with the emerging economic crisis this country is going to face, to deal with the hardship that people will face losing their homes, or the health insurance crisis that many Americans face. These are major issues. The long term in getting shorter all the time, but the implications of global warming. We need people who are unencumbered by, you know, these considerations of the next election to be able to make decisions for the long term. Our current system doesn't allow for that. It really takes extraordinary, visionary people to get out from underneath the fundraising in order to look beyond the horizon of the next 2 years. And that's, you know, that's really what's selling America short, because we do have great leaders among us. They're just not opting to go into public service.
I think if a lot of people understood where we're sitting here at this moment, geographically, we are about, as the crow flies, a mile away from a very powerful street called K Street. Mm-hmm. And I think if many of the voters in this country understood, the voters themselves, the individual voters, if you understood how much power you have politically compared to what this small street in Washington has because of money, I think you would be appalled.
You can almost hear the money changing hands over there, huh?
Yeah, you can.
It's and there, you know, those are the folks that are now taking leave from their jobs, the lobbyists on K Street, to go work on the presidential campaigns and working on John McCain's campaign mostly. They will be able to go back after taking a few months leave. They're, you know, they certainly have the financial wherewithal to leave their jobs, not like many Americans. And you think about the 6- and 7-figure contracts that they will reap when they get back if their man gets elected president. And that's the sound of money that you're hearing changing hands right now.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
The access that some of these people will have. And not all lobbyists are bad. You know, maybe you'll disagree with me on this one.
No, not all. I don't like the word all.
Right. And I think many of them hate being hit up all the time. They just don't like being on the receiving end. Right now, it's not just about them giving. It's about them going to clients, you know, all their clients, and shaking down their clients to give. And some of them are just, they're a little tired of that game. They've been doing, they want to go back to just being an expert on policy or on the process. Money is really now the currency.
Well, Dave, you've been in a lot of, I have, and I'm assuming you have. You have sat in the lobby and the greeting meeting rooms of a lot of political offices,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Congressmen and senators and all that.
Yeah.
Who mostly do you see sitting in the chairs waiting in the offices?
Huh? No, you see the citizens waiting there. You know, you wait long hours sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah. But who do you mostly see there?
Well, I mean,
you go in and there's like in my senator's office, and there are 12 people waiting. Who do you think about 8 of them are?
Yeah, well, they're people who generally represent the interests that they're being
paid
to
represent. They're
lobbyists. Yeah, they're there, and the really influential ones would just pick up the phone and call them, right?
They're, yeah.
You know, once in a while, when I go into some of those offices, I see a fair number of citizens that have waited a long time, to see the senator or see the junior staffer. Because that's typically who they'll get to see, while the senator is probably across the street at the campaign committee making phone calls to raise money for the next re-election.
And that would be another thing, to be able to free up our legislators
to do
the jobs they were elected to do.
Precisely, yeah. And I think, that's what they want to do. I know that they prefer the system they have, than a new system, many of them. But I don't think they like the system that they have. They just like it a little bit better than the uncertainty of having a challenger run against them all the time.
Yeah, you're absolutely right on that. I have a relative who, well, my listeners know, the treasurer of the United States during the Clinton administration is my cousin, Mary Ellen Withrow. And she was treasurer of the state of Ohio and all that. And we were having dinner the other night. And Mary Ellen, what did you like least about politics?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the national treasurer's kind of out of, it was a political appointment, but
right.
What did you like least about
right.
Well, having to raise money.
Yeah, no, appearing at the fundraisers,
It's a long, glad-handing, rubber chicken torture.
Yeah, it is, and particularly at that level. It's you spend a lot of time doing it, and it's a blur, and it's just, think about the skill set that you need to do that well, doesn't necessarily translate to the skill set of what it takes to be a good lawmaker or to be a good treasury secretary or to be, you know, or anything else in government. So, I mean, that, you know, that's a really good, you know, if you're really good at that, you can be a good salesman, right?
Yeah.
You know, you can sell, you know, Hoover cleaners door to door. But those are, you know, we're not electing salesmen, right? We're not electing shakedown artists. We're electing leaders.
We're not electing people that we need to have a beer with or be
that's
friendly.
Right, that's right.
I hope. I hope. Done that, yeah. But been there, done that.
Yeah.
Dave, your website?
Campaignmoney.org.
Campaignmoney.org. And Open Secrets, is that org or .com?
It's an org, yeah.
Yeah.
It's
for those of you who haven't been, campaignmoney.org.
Yep. Right.
I'm writing this down. You can tell I'm really. campaignmoney.org. And by the way, if you haven't visited Open Secrets, we've talked about it in the past, again, take a look over there and type in your zip code. You want to see what your neighbors are doing. You have every right to. You're not intruding on anybody. That's public knowledge. Mm-hmm. Check it out. You find some interesting things in your very own neighborhood. I promise you.
That's right.
Dave Donnelly, thanks very, very much. Director of Campaign Money Watch. I can't tell you how important I think that is. I think it's that, in my personal opinion, along with some term limits, probably the two most important things we could do in politics. And hold people's feet to the fire once they get in as well. Dave Donnelly, thank you so much for being on
the
program.
Thanks for having me.
We've had good people here today. I've really enjoyed this a lot, and we will be sure and check out that website. And I know that's something that you all are extremely interested in as well. If we don't get the money out of control, it will snowball on us. It's snowballing right now, and hopefully we can put a stop to some of this and slow down this snowball that's going down the hill, and get it back to reasonable levels where your money and your time is more important than the fat cat's money and the fat cat's time. And we don't need to have these people preoccupied with raising money. We don't need to have them, you know, have that be the only thing that they're doing in life is raising money. It's just, it's not proper. It's unseemly, and it's just not the way that our forefathers set things out to be. We're going to pause for a break coming up in whenever Bob gets ready, and we're going to round up another guest, and we'll act.
The Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
Tune in to Foxed Up this Thursday, midnight Eastern, for part two of Lenin on Lenin, Blame It on Bermuda, where we'll examine the creative process and how the ideas for Double Fantasy happened.
When we made a tentative decision to make a record, I didn't have any material, then suddenly it all came to me. All the songs that are on Double Fantasy all came within a period of 3 weeks. In Bermuda after 5 years of nothing.
So be there this Thursday, midnight Eastern, on Foxed Up. Right here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
I just have to let it go.
This is Billy Shears, and hey, thanks for lending an ear.
Has anyone ever said, you are the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened.
Screening can find precancerous polyps so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
If you or someone close to you has a hearing loss, here is some great news. Thousands of Open Caption videos are yours to borrow, and it's all free. Open Caption videos make it possible for the hearing impaired to understand television. The Caption Media Program offers classic Hollywood movies, special interest, and educational videos. Visit us online at cfv.org or call 1-800-237-6213. You can register to be a user and make your selections from our online or printed catalog. It's just that easy, and we'll even pay for the postage. Open Caption videos are perfect for the classroom, your home, or even the workplace. The nonprofit Caption Media Program is funded by the U.S. Department of Education and administered by the National Association of the Deaf. Tell a family member or a friend about the Caption Media Program today. Bookmark cfv.org for free loan Open Caption videos or call 1-800-237-6213.
Back with you, Guy James, here at the Head On Radio Network. We're at the Take Back America Conference, as if you didn't know. A lot going on right at the moment. Looks like they're getting ready for something in the hall, probably another big event this evening in conjunction with the Take Back America Conference. People everywhere setting up tables, tearing down tables. My. I must say the staff at a big facility like the Omni Shoreham Hotel here certainly works hard. They work extremely hard putting this whole hall together for this. And, of course, there are many, many, many events taking place here at the Omni Shoreham right now. I'm talking many. There are probably a dozen different functions in conjunction with the Campaign for America's Future conference taking on right going on right now. We have the big gala dinner tonight. A whole lot taking place in this hall. So if you hear a little background noise, well, so be it. I don't have to tell you. You've heard me talk about it in the past. And I've been criticized in the past, talking about how much I love Washington, D.C. I hate some of the things that happens here, but I do love this town. We're in a very historic part of town, and one part of the town I haven't spent a whole lot of time in up until now. It's the Adams Morgan District, and we're up close to the National Cathedral, not very far up the street from here. And if you have never been to Washington, I'd say on the top three or four places that you should see would, without question, be the National Cathedral. A spectacular cathedral here in Washington, D.C. You can see it from all over town. It's the highest point in town, I think. Maybe the Washington Monument's higher. I'm not exactly sure. Cathedral is on a hill. And so no matter where you're at in Washington, you can look around and you can see the National Cathedral. So if you ever come here, if you ever bring the family in, and by the way, if you've got a family, if you've got kids, everybody should come to this town and find out what this town is all about. That's everybody should come and learn about Washington. You know, the way my parents did this before the first time I ever came to Washington, D.C. is, and my father was a stickler on this little family history here, but no matter where we went, we would go to Gettysburg or someplace of historical significance, and my father was a real historian, and he instilled the love of history in me. No matter where we went, we would have to study. Dad would hand out some books to my brother and I, and we would have to study Gettysburg, for example, say Andersonville, any of the historical places, the South. We went south a lot. And we'd have to learn all about the history of it before we got there, and it made it infinitely more interesting. And so rather than, if you ever bring kids here, rather than just spring everything on them as a surprise and have them learn it later, have them study it up a little bit before you go. And when they get there, why, then you can point out, well, you know what this building's for, and you know what that building's for, and it makes it so, so interesting for everybody. So lots of great things here in this town. The Capitol building, of course, in my opinion, the most magnificent building on the planet. I have not been to every building on the planet, of course, but I think the Capitol building is the most magnificent and, of course, the most meaningful building to people here in the United States. It makes my heart flutter every time I walk into it. I've been there many, many times, and I know many of you have as well, and there's a feeling that comes over you. And that's why it's so important to take back America. It's been getting away from us. And when I come to this town, it reminds me. Because it's worth it. When I look at the great things in this town, the beautiful edifices in this town, the great structures, Arlington Cemetery, all the things here, it reminds me of exactly why that we have to take back America. People that have, in the past, that have worked so hard to keep this country free, people in the past that have worked so hard to write the laws, that we would have great human rights in this country, that we would not be involved in torture, that we would not be involved in spying on our citizens. So many things that the founders didn't intend, are taking place in our country right now. And we have to get it back. And one of the reasons for this conference is exactly that, to take this country back and to take it back from people whose hands should not have hold of it. And I mentioned K Street. Yes, there are some honest people on K Street. In fact, maybe most of the people on K Street are honest. I don't know. I haven't polled them all. But I do know that K Street is involved in not just influence, they're involved in buying influence in this country. And that's not what representative government is about. That's never what it should have been about. But I'm afraid we have gotten there where you can buy. And of course, that's taken place a lot in the country over the years. But it's getting worse and worse and worse. And don't let anybody tell you that there's not people taking big campaign dollars in this country aren't being bought, because a lot of them are. I'm not indicting everybody with that. Certainly not, but a lot of people do in fact give big contributions, and they are in fact buying influence, attempting to, and in many cases, as we've seen in the Duke Cunninghams and with those kind of people, they are successful in buying influence. So we've got to put a stop to it. We've got to get this huge money out of politics somehow. There's a reason why K Street's down. Where any of you know where the term lobby came from? If memory serves me correct, I think it started in the Ulysses S. Grant administration, I believe. I could be talking out of school here, so Google this or look it up. But I believe that the term lobbying really started during the Grant administration, when he would walk down the street to the Willard Hotel and meet people that wanted to see him about things in the lobby. And they would sit and jaw and smoke cigars and drink and do whatever they did. And that's where that term came from. That's the way I understand it. That's where I remember it from my history book when I was a kid. So maybe I should have looked up that up before I started talking about it. But that's what I remember. Now, like Mr. Donnelly, our last guest, said, they don't necessarily have to go visit them and go lobby. They just call them on the phone and say, hey, bud, we contributed $25,000 to your campaign, and we know you're going to help us out on this next vote. I see my compadre Mark Levine's over here. Mark, what are they setting up here anyway? They're setting up a banquet for you and I,
I think it's all about us. I think that they're going to praise us and the wonderful work of the horn for all we've done all these years. It's a secret surprise so secret that you and I don't know about it, but I'm sure that's what it's about.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Now, there is a segment where they're going to lift us up in chairs. Are you okay with that?
Yeah.
All right.
Oh,
okay.
Well, they're going to be able to lift you up a lot easier than they're going to be able to lift. They're going to need some extra guys.
Well, you know, they got like 20 people ready to go, guys.
Yeah.
So
they're setting up big silver punch bowls.
They are. I'm sure it's got to be for the dramatic work of the horn in being America's liberal voice. It's got to be. I mean, what else could it be?
I hadn't thought about it.
What else could it be? I mean, who does more work for progressive movement than you and I and Bob Kincaid and John Fox and Peter Gobbold? It's got to be for us.
And claims it. And claims I am a progressive, I am a liberal,
that's, right.
That's what I'm doing.
And is unafraid. That's exactly right.
Who else does that? Can you think of anybody?
No.
You know, I think it's some of the big names.
If it's not for us, it should be, and that's all I got to say on this matter.
All right. Well, there's a lot of glasses there. They're evidently they're going to be booze involved. There's Coke. There's Perrier. I don't know. I wasn't aware this was going to happen, but I love surprises. I do.
to dream the impossible dream. What can I say?
They're unfolding. There it is. There's the big banner. They're unfolding it now. They're hanging it on the curtains over there, dedicated to the gentleman from the horn.
I think it is. It's got to be.
I love it. You got a full slate of guests for your show today?
I hope so. I got Josh Silver coming. He's going to talk about the press. He and I have been giving each other, let's just say, attitude for a while now. So I think we should let our listeners find out who's right about this. He's going to argue that actually the media isn't as bad as we think it is. Come on. I mean, he's full of it. But we'll find out. We got him on.
He's going to argue that the media isn't as bad as we think.
I think that's what he said. No. He's shaking his head. All right. We'll find out. We'll find out. It's just coming up in a few minutes.
Okay. Well, you couldn't argue that.
He couldn't possibly argue that. And then I've got Rob Call of Op-Ed News. Rob Call and I used to work together way back in 2000 when we were fighting the Supreme Court decision. We tried to overturn the Florida delegates. He, of course, runs Op-Ed News, which has done a tremendous job.
They've got a display around here in the.
Live from Washington, it's the Inside Scoop, with all the news the government does not want you to know. Now, here's the host of the Inside Scoop, Congressional Attorney Mark Levin.
Good evening, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. It's been about 5 years since I have hosted the Inside Scoop, giving you the news the government does not want you to know. I'm, of course, an ex-congressional attorney for the Democrats, having worked on the Homeland Security Department and the Judiciary Committee. But today, in the shadow of April 1st, I've come to a realization. I think I've done it all wrong. You know, the government is a very powerful thing. And maybe we should only talk about the things the government does want us to know. After all, if we serve our government, then our government can serve us. So I've decided today, in the shadow of April 1st, to make an announcement. I'm going to join the Republican Party. Now, that doesn't mean I'll accept everything in the Republican Party. For example, I think John McCain is way too liberal. I think that my real heroes, Ann Coulter, Rush Limbaugh, all these people who tell me how to think will direct me and help me in this process. And to help me in this journey, I've invited a Republican on air right here, Mike Lane, the president of Intellifence Strategies. And Mike, I'm wearing red. I am joining your party today.
Mark, I wish I could say welcome. But surprising as it is that you would tell me this, I've been undergoing a journey myself and thinking about this actually for an extended period of time, but more recently, I have just been absolutely appalled by the complete intolerance, controlling wackiness, lead my life for me kind of attitude of my former colleagues. And I was going to surprise you tonight by telling you that I had come to your side because I just can't deal with those controlling, intolerant freaks anymore.
Well, and that's ridiculous.
I'm wearing blue.
To be a Democrat. Well, Mike, look, I mean, I've been thinking this over. This isn't a decision I've come to lightly. For example, the Iraq War. McCain says we need to be there 100 years. 100 years is not enough.
It could be 1,000 years. It could be 10,000 years. Perpetual war helps the American economy and asserts American hegemony over the world. The world knows us as their overlords, as their masters. And that's the kind of America I want to be, king of the world. And so I was going to come here and announce tonight that we need more wars, and not just Iraq, and not just Iran and Afghanistan, but Syria, the entire Middle East. I also think we need to take Canada, because if we invade Canada, we can connect Alaska up. What are the Canucks?